Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Thank you all for making it. We're going to be the number one media conglomerate in the world. The key here is act like a happy family. We're the Osbournes, and I'm Daddy fucking Warbucks, okay?
I always wanted one of you kids to take over.
People would do well to remember there's going to be a new sheriff in town.
Here's to us.
Hello and welcome to the penultimate episode of Still Watching Succession, a podcast about the HBO series Succession. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week on this show, we like to break down what is happening with the Roy family over here on Succession. And we will be sort of getting into our rankings of like where we think the various members of the Roy family are standing after this trip to Washington. I believe the line was Mr. Fuck goes to Washington. So we are in D.C. this week for season 2, episode 9, called D.C., directed by Mark Millad and written by Emmy winner Jesse Armstrong. So here we are, the cream of the crop. Before we dive into what actually happened in the episode itself, I just wanted to hit a few emails really quickly from listeners. Melissa writes in response to an episode a couple weeks ago when Logan went and hit Roman in the face, and Kendall sort of hopped in to defend him. Listener Melissa wrote in and reminded me that in season 1, Logan does a similar thing to Kendall's son. Like, the show's kind of forgotten that Kendall has kids and an ex-wife. They're sort of, like, absent from the season entirely. But he has a kid who seems to have, like, some sort of maybe behavioral difficulties, and Logan just smacks him in the face, and Kendall says no. But, like, they say no to Logan, and then nothing, like, no actual consequences happen, right? Like,
right, yeah.
It's just no and roll on from there, so... Yeah. So, that was from Melissa. If you have any insight you want to add to us, you can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. A friend of mine, Kim Renfro, who writes for Business Insider, was at, the Emmys, and she got a chance to talk to some of the cast while she was there. And she floated to Jeremy Strong our like theory that Kendall is very Theon Greyjoy this season. And Jeremy Strong got a big kick out of that. So you can read her piece sort of over on Business Insider about what Jeremy Strong thinks of comparing Kendall to Theon Greyjoy. I think it's a pretty solid comparison, and he seemed to think so as well. So, that is some stuff and some business. So let us dive right into this episode. What we like to do is sort of run down who we think is on top and who is on the bottom after this week. We start on the top because it's always fun to end with kind of the losers. So we're going to start with, I don't know that he's ever been on top of this ranking that we do, but we're going to start with number one boy, Roman Roy.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, why does Roman deserve the top spot this week?
Well, he not only got a compliment from Dad, he got a like friendly shoulder touch from Dad, and then he also, you know, averted seemingly some sort of geopolitical crisis and sealed the deal to get this shifty Azerbaijani money.
Right. He got the money. He kept a clear head. while Carl was having a panic attack by him. I really love this. You know, you never know what you're going to love when Succession decides to mix and match various players. But this little grouping of Carl and Laird and Roman was endlessly entertaining to me. So I really hope that they put these three together in the future. I'm a big fan of them.
Yeah, it's sort of those two with Roman are sort of like, I mean, a lot of characters on this show are sort of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you know, just
yeah,
these like pathetic people in the background who have like access to power and yet are constantly being sort of thrown around. And I'm sure we're going to hear about them dying off screen sometime on this show.
Right. But yeah, and it was surprisingly, like, I think the concept is sort of that, Laird and Carl would handle, I think Logan said something like the logistics or something like that. And Roman was there just to sort of press the flesh. Mm-hmm. But I think Roman really, really rose to the occasion in a way that, you know, Jerry has kind of been saying that he could, if he put his mind to it. So this makes me think if we're clinging to my theory of like each season's going to focus on one Roy kid, I'm wondering if next season is a Roman season. If he ends the season on a high note of some kind. So
yeah, no, I think that feels right. Yeah. And I think that you know, in terms of, I guess we've seen this season that the other, well, not Connor, but like Shiv and Kendall are sort of still somewhat compromised by a sense of not only morals, but of sort of self-regard. Whereas Roman just doesn't really have any of that. You know, he thinks right. He's a piece of shit. He doesn't mind being a piece of shit. He doesn't mind telling people he's a piece of shit. And I think that makes him kind of grimly effective in this world.
Right. And people just like him, you know what I mean?
Because like, he's honest about it, you know, like, you know, I think that that's probably pretty refreshing when you have all these other people pretending like they're, you know, decent folks.
Yeah. And then we have a great bit of comedy, which is him having to give a pep talk to his football club, soccer team, the
Hearts.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Just a tremendous moment. I really hope that, you know, whenever they take on these various, very specific scenarios, it feels like the Succession staff has done their homework. And I really hope they went to actual footballers and were like, what is some of the stupidest things your clueless owners have ever said to
right.
you? Great. We're going to write it down verbatim. Thanks so much. So yeah. So Roman doing well. What do you make of his sort of, they play this game of fuck, marry, kill with the executive floor. And he has his Jerry reaction. What do you make of him protesting so much about Jerry?
Yeah, too much, I would say. I mean, yeah. I think that, like, I almost detected a note of jealousy, even though this was this dumb theoretical game, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he was kind of like, no, like, no one is supposed to see Jerry as some sort of viable partner. That's my thing, you know? And I don't know that necessarily anyone picked up on his sort of, you know, overcompensating, you know, disgust, but it was... You know, I think this show is very good about remembering and not letting anything really go. Well, maybe Kendall's kids, but you know, like little plot details. I mean, the way that Mo kind of comes back into this episode in a big way, and you're like, oh, that's why we went to that funeral however many episodes ago. And I think
right.
You know, the show is not going to let us forget about this thing that Roman and Jerry did.
Absolutely. And we got this a little bit last week when there was this implication that Jerry and Logan might have had something maybe once upon a time, and Roman kind of casually lost his shit about that. So, you know, it's been a while since we've had an encounter of that nature between them, but I'm pulling for these crazy kids. That brings us to number two, another Roy boy. Rising in the charts. It's Kendall Roy. First, I have a quick check-in with you, Richard. Did you ever eventually go back and watch the Kendall Roy rap from last week that you were too embarrassed to watch?
Not only did I not do that, Joanna, I muted Roman's speech to the soccer team. I couldn't do it. I can't do it. I'm weak.
I love it.
I'm at the bottom of the power ranking for both these episodes.
And you managed to avoid seeing it, even though like it's all Twitter could talk about this week. You managed to avoid all memes, all everything about Logan's rep.
Look, when I want to avoid something, yeah, I can. I have ways. But yeah, I think that Kendall for that, and I guess it wasn't really embarrassing because people actually seemed to get into it eventually with the rap last week. But like this week, he, you know, after sort of being mildly tossed under the bus by his father in front of Congress, bounces back with the kind of, you know, red meat, Fox Newsy rhetoric that tends to play really well for certain contingents in Washington and the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And he did a great job. There is that, yes, that one moment that Logan, who, when he starts to flounder ever so slightly, is like, oh, I don't know, my son, mm-hmm. you know, and then there's like zoom in on Kendall, going, yoinks. But Kendall throughout that hearing does an incredible job. His little sass back, about like state controlled media and stuff like that, which we got a nice Jerry reaction to, he acquitted himself incredibly well. And, we were able to see that in comparison to maybe how someone else, did in front of that committee. And we will get to that person. But, I would say all three of the kids, Roman, Kendall, and Shiv, really came, or sorry, I forgot about Connor. those three kids really came through, for Logan and for the company, in their various missions this week.
And I think that what Jesse Armstrong did so shrewdly in the writing of this episode was that Logan teed each of the three up to succeed at what they do best. Roman being sort of sniveling and unscrupulous, Shiv holding herself to a moral ideal, but using that to do kind of amoral things. And then Kendall is just loves to stump for dear old dad, you know, and loves to defend the company. Like that's what he does. Even if he ends up seeming like a bit of a hard charger or, you know, a windbag or whatever. And those are their kind of three primary skills. And Logan and all of his, you know, savvy, put them in place to do exactly what they're best at.
Yes. Sometimes he sets them up to succeed and sometimes he sets them up to fail. Mm-hmm. And he has no memory of their successes whenever they do fail. So, you know. Okay. So that is our number two, Kendall. He also has, after his whirlwind romance with the actress Jennifer, I doubt he remembers her name, Naomi Pierce is back in the mix, standing by his side. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about the use of Naomi in this episode and what it means that she's there?
I was a little surprised because I sort of figured that she was out of the picture after the whole actress thing, but I think maybe they are setting up something more longer term with that. Like maybe they figured, okay, so Kendall's been out in the wild this whole season. Maybe next season they want to see him. Maybe, I mean, whatever his version of settling down is.
Right.
Maybe the kids will come back into the picture next season. You know, I think that like, Kendall was spinning out into space in this most of the season. And now they're kind of bringing him back. He had just had a big win with not only the company, but with his dad and maybe this.
And his tremendous rap.
His tremendous rap that I'll never see. and now maybe like he's found something approximating a stable relationship. And who is it with? Another kind of embittered and yet still seemingly somewhat loyal member of a big family media company.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Who else has drug problems? Like,
right. So my thought had been that like Logan's disapproval meant Naomi was out of the picture, and then his disapproval of the actress meant she was out of the picture. But for him to bring Naomi back, or like it almost seems like Naomi showed up of her own accord, like he was surprised to see her there.
Right.
And so, you know, she gets points with him for doing that. And then he tries again. He's like, hey, dad, Naomi's here to support us. And Logan's like, don't care. Bye. So, you know, Kendall's still trying for that approval of whoever it is he's dating. All right. So number three on our list is not a Roy kid.
Mm-mm.
It's good old Bill.
Teflon Bill. They were going to try to put him in front of the firing squad, but then he kind of, by really not doing anything on his own, just kind of dodged it all.
Well, he let Logan know that he kept journals so could write a book if he needed to. Mm-hmm. And it was just a really savvy, friendly. I mean, so Bill had been set up the entire time. Like, we met him in season one when he's handing over the reins to Tom. And he's like well liked and everyone loves him. But he also has these various strategies in place for like how to pass over the information. I don't know if you remember that whole thing. It's very Byzantine. He's like, I'm going to type this thing, I'm going to print it. It's like an airlocked computer. I'm going to print it out. It's the whole, like, Bill had his safeties in place. He's not just shredding documents on Thanksgiving, like Tom. And, but Bill has this reputation of being so nice that everyone's like, oh, okay, obviously. We'll just pin it on all on Bill. We like Bill, but RIP Bill. Adios, Billy Boy. Kill Bill is a fun, drink every time they say Kill Bill in this episode. They say it a lot. And then he survives. Wriggles out at the last minute. So there you go.
I think he's a good example of these smaller characters who the Roy family thinks like they always got one up on, but like all these people at the company who have access to the secrets to where the bodies are buried and whatnot, like a lot of them are shrewd enough to have gotten to that position and also were smart enough to cover themselves, you know? And I think that like it's always kind of fun when the immediate Roy family realizes that like people have protected themselves against them, you know? And I think even Jerry kind of, you know, I think if you kind of put together all the times in any of the, you know, these conversations over the past two seasons, when something falls to her, she always pivots a little bit. So she has so much plausible deniability, and you see how competent she was in the hearing, you know, in a way. And I think Bill is another example of that. He's like someone who like took care to protect himself, but didn't draw any attention to that. He's not a blusterer. And I think that those ultimately seem to be the kind of people who survive these daily apocalypses.
Yeah, we don't have Jerry officially on our ranking this week, but I would happily put her up here with Bill because the only reason she's in this committee hearing is because like Hugo kind of threw her under the bus. And it was this great moment where he was like, yeah, Jerry and Tom. And she goes, excuse me? Because this is exactly the kind of thing that Jerry always tries to wriggle her way out of. We saw it in that like our Jesties episode where she's like, oh no, not me. I send the wrong message. Someone else should do it. You know what I mean? And so she couldn't wriggle her way out of this one. But she shows up, she sits in front of the committee, and she says stuff like, I have no knowledge of that. She has this great line where she's like, I'm not an IT expert. I don't know. She just like deflects without going overboard the way that Tom does when he's like, I don't even know who Greg is, you know?
And she's so movie. Jay Smith Cameron, it just gets the tone of, because we've all seen a lot of congressional hearings after the past couple years, I feel like. And she just gets the tone of like kind of flat affect, not cold or standoffish, but just sort of like competent but vague, you know? And just kind of like, well, it just, you know, that's kind of the part of the just regular routine of data management, you know? Like very professional sounding, doesn't give anything away. I just thought that was like a perfectly calibrated little scene for J. Smith Cameron, and she nailed it.
Yeah, love it. All right, so that brings us to another person in that room. Our future president, President Connor Roy, the third Roy boy on the list here. Connor didn't do a ton in this episode, but he gets up the charts for a couple reasons. Number one, we find out that he's got a surge, a groundswell of support by a group called the Conheads, right? Not like Coneheads, but Conheads. He seemed as surprised as us to find out that he has that support. So the other reason I think Connor, rose up the ranks in my estimation is this great speech he gives on how it's useless to have $5 million. How you're like, what, the poor,
the tallest,
yeah, budget. The poorest millionaire. Love that stuff from him. It's just like Alan Ruck is so good in this role, and just always like pitch perfect with everything he does. And then there's this other great moment where I think it's when Kendall says something particularly great and Connor gives like a sort of yes sort of fist pump in the background.
Yeah,
Because he's a buffoon. But I think that people like a buffoon, as we are all too aware these days. He's a useful buffoon. And I thought it was a really funny little detail that when the guy comes over and it's like, you know, we're all behind you, you know, we're the con heads or whatever. Connor's like, oh, thank you. Like, God bless you. You know, and like, so he's already trying to get like pretend as if he grew up in anything
religious,
sort of faith-based, you know, I think of course, cause of course that would be part of the equation. And I think that's like, that was a really smart detail. And I think also we had the detail of this, you know, very, I think he was from Missouri, the senator.
Yes.
The family. I've been on your cruises, you know, and you're like, okay, so we have a lobbyist type in a suit coming up and saying, we support you. We have a senator saying the same thing. And it's like, okay, they are absolutely laying the groundwork for this guy to win.
Connor's still pretty high on the ranks. And then we get to Rhea, who has a tough week, but she's not bottom of the ranking because it ends with her seemingly getting out, right? She's washing her hands of Waystar Roy Coe. Someone on Twitter, I think it was, like, challenged me to say Waystar Roy Coe 5 times fast. I can't even say it once. I never managed to land it. So you guys can try that at home if you think you're better at it than me.
Waco Roystar, right? Was that it?
But Rhea's out. Not fungible, but out. We could just say this about every single actor on the show, but I really love Holly Hunter, this week in terms of the extreme displeasure rating off of Rhea. No, she knows she's been outmaneuvered, put in a tight spot. She shows up, she gives this little like pep talk at the beginning of the episode, but she's not like yelling or losing. She's just so mad at herself, mad at the situation, just this tightness sort of like in her mouth. What do you think about Rhea this week?
Yeah. I mean, I like that she kind of explained, she's like, you know, I know that you're basically a bad person, and yet I'm still sort of like, I find you appealing, you know? And I think that that is the pull of so many of these, you know, sort of bad masters of the universe, including the president currently, you know, people say, well, you know, in a room, he's kind of charming. And so I think that like the whole Rhea arc seems to be about at least one person, having that spell broken. And so, you know, it's maybe not the most like, satisfied, like I feel like they could have, you know, Holly Hunter could have done that if she indeed is done on the show, like could have done a lot more. And yet I think that this was like an important sort of character arc to have on the show, you know, a principled person who gets wooed into this world because it's exciting and it has access to an incredible amount of power. And you know, when Logan is favorable to you, it is like a weird kind of mostly indifferent sun shining on you. And then to have her be like, wait, what am I doing? And she had that moment with Shiv where she tried to sort of save her essentially. And then she couldn't. And, you know, I think that was probably the last
straw. Yeah. I mean, I don't think of Rhea as entirely principled, you know, because she wants her power. She wants whatever, but she does have her line and she realizes that being associated with these people crosses a line for her that she's unwilling to be on the other side of. And I love that moment with Shiv when they get in the car. Rhea says something like, this doesn't feel great. And Shiv says something like, yeah, like soft, you know, shit, womanly duty or whatever. Like basically like, I don't want to be given the woman's job. And Rhea's like, that's not why this doesn't feel great. It's not what I'm talking about. So, really great stuff. I feel like this might be the last we see of Rhea this season, but Holly Hunter feels like the kind of person who might show up, like sort of like Eric Bogosian did in this season, like an episode or two next season, something, you know, she's still in the world, you know, ditto Cherry Jones. Speaking of like women disappearing though, like, Roman asks about Marsha in this episode. Do you feel like we're going to see Marsha again?
I would guess there'll be some sort of reckoning next week, but, maybe I'm wrong. I don't think they would dismiss her quite like that. Although this season, as it's, you know, neared its end, has seen people jumping ship. I mean, cruises. But like, and so maybe that's kind of narrative what the show is doing, is it's trying to isolate these people in the sort of
hell of their own, you know, decision making, and without any really other people to turn to. I mean, like, even like someone like Bill is like, oh, no, I have an insurance policy. You're all fucked. Like, goodbye.
Right.
You know, like, I think that there's a certain, loneliness kind of mounted, like, looming in front of like the core Roy family.
Yeah. And do you feel like that's why, like, one of the reasons why Logan was leaning on his kids so much, like, with Marcia gone and Rhea not a source of that for him, like, he turns back to his kids.
I think for sure. And I think, you know, we see a bit in this episode and in the show in general, but particularly in this episode with that dynamic, like, why huge companies remain family companies sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Roman says something about that. He, like, when he's giving his pitch, he says something like, you know, the tech industry would have you believe that legacy companies, you know, are ruining America. He's like, but that's not the case. We're stability. We provide stability. Mm-hmm. We provide actual money, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, that is interesting. All right. So that, brings us right over to Logan, conveniently enough, who's smack dab in the middle because, he doesn't get, you know, roasted the way that he might have. But he doesn't come out completely unscathed from this episode. This episode starts with, one of my favorite images of the series ever, which is, just whenever they show the back of his head, they show the back of his head as he's sort of like wandering through Central Park, I guess, like going from his apartment to one of his kids or something like that. I don't really know the path that he was taking, but it's the back of his head, which is sort of iconic from the opening credits. And I don't know, just like forces you to really reckon with like the shadow of Logan, like without Brian, like Brian Cox's face, you just have to be like, what is this? Like, what is this iconoclast? Like, what is this figure that I'm reckoning with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that like he's in the middle because, like you said, he couldn't avert everything. He did still get hauled in front of Congress, which is an embarrassment in a way. He had to read a contrite message from an iPad in front of Congress.
Right.
You know, that is not something that Logan Roy is supposed to be doing. But he's not all the way at the bottom by any means, because especially in that final scene with Shiv, he still bares his teeth. He shows his power. He's like, there's got to be a blood sacrifice. And you know, he that could be anyone, you know, but it's going to be someone big. And do we have any indication?
I think it's Tom. We can talk about why when we get.
And that's why he had that conversation with Shiv in particular.
Right.
Maybe. Yeah.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of questions about that. But yeah, so that's Logan sort of in the middle. He started strong in that hearing, you know what I mean? Reading off his iPad and doing a little charming, like, who am I to contradict, you know, Mr. Emerson or whatever. But then he did sort of start to fumble in his slightly like sundowning way. You get the shot of Gil being like, what is happening here? And that's when he just reverted to throwing Kendall right into the bus there. So. There we go. All right. And that brings us to number six, which is Shiv. And this is a complicated, question. We had a question of like whether Shiv should be on top or on the bottom this week. So we sort of compromised, with like near the bottom. And it's because yes, she quote unquote won, but at what cost and what is she going to have to do next? So, go ahead. Yeah. What do you?
No, yeah. I'm just saying it's a complicated kind of character moment for her. I mean, I should say, you know, when we're trying to decide these things, it's very much like that outtake from Waiting for Guffman of Parker Posey saying, who's on top and who's on bottom now? That's what you say every time when you call me for one of these recordings. I mean, I think that like from one perspective, she did her little child task, you know, like she succeeded like Kendall and Roman also succeeded. She got this, you know, complainant, this victim of sexual harassment to, you know, rethink her testimony. Mm-hmm. So, okay, a victory there. But I think that as we saw in the car with Rhea, like she really has now divested herself of all the supposed principles she had in season one when she's working for Gil, and you know, when she's like on the liberal side of things, whatever. Like, she's now just fully of that, of the Roy machine. And I think that is kind of a loss for her. So that's why she's toward the bottom this week.
Yeah. And I really do. I feel like she's being set up to have to sacrifice Tom. And so she's sent to, you know, do this errand for her father, talk this woman who I saw as sort of supposed to be like a Christine Blasey Ford sort of analog. This actress that they got for the role, Sally Murphy, has just like a very similar, like a soft-spoken sort of demeanor and kind of look to her. And so it's sort of like, to me, it struck me as like, what would have happened if she had been talked out of testifying? A lot of the arguments that Shiv is making speaks directly to what happened to Christine Blasey Ford, who, if you don't remember, testified in the Kavanaugh hearing, like, you know, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, and her life was like essentially destroyed as a result of it, and he was still confirmed. And so it's like, Shiv's not entirely wrong, right?
No, and that's the kind of really bitter thing about that scene, and it's such a well-written scene, and is like, exactly, you know, but the thing is that Shiv is not wrong, but she's acting in defense of the people who would prove her right, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
She's acting in defense of the people who would ruin her life. You know, so she's saying, like, don't, I mean, like, please don't let my dogs bite you.
You know? Oh, a nice life would be a real shame if something happened to it. Yeah, it's, like, when this woman asks, like, can I trust you? And Shiv says, no. She's both telling the truth and making a calculated play here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the kind of downfall of Shiv this season is that she increasingly doesn't know anymore. Can't really tell the difference, you know?
Yeah.
She's just completely lost herself in the game.
Yeah. So I don't know if they're showing us doing, like, showing her do this despicable thing in this episode so that she can do the right thing in the finale. You know what I mean? Like, modulating it that way. Like, this is bottom for Shiv. And then if she's asked to sacrifice Tom in the finale, maybe she won't. I don't know what would be the more surprising and or narratively satisfying outcome. If Logan is actually asking for Shiv to sacrifice Tom because Bill is off the table, and knowing this, like, I watched this episode a little while ago, and then I went back and rewatched the whole season, and there's just like this slow tightening of a noose around Tom all season. And whenever Tom looks to Shiv for reassurance of like, I'm not getting fucked, am I? Like, he asks it in almost every episode. She's like distracted. She's on her phone. She's like, what? No, you're fine. You know, like it. And so, you know, if you're a betting man, like maybe you would bet that Shiv is not going to show up for him. But then I don't know if Succession is the kind of show where it would be more narratively satisfying for her to surprise us all and show up for him in the 11th hour, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for Shiv, the Tom problem, the Tom question is that partly the reason that she's with him at all is as a tool.
Right.
And eventually the tool is going to lose its utility and she was going to have to get rid of it. And so I think that she just doesn't want to confront the fact that, like, she kind of always knew that Tom was going to have to be neutralized at some point, right? Or euthanized even. And I think that, like, she just, like, would prefer to look at her phone than deal with that, you know?
Yeah, her meat puppet, as it were, you know, and I think it's Logan, or maybe it was even her mom, Caroline, or maybe both of them, basically when she married Tom, being like, you're marrying beneath you, like, you're better than this person, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, Shiv probably knows it, but I mean, like, I would like, I don't know what I would prefer. We'll talk about it a little bit more when we get to Tom. All right. So, right above, the Tom slot is Gil and Gil's assistant, Nate. Nate, you might recall in season one, had this affair with Shiv. There's something interesting and possibly very personal about this attack on Tom, because you see Nate sort of very specifically as the hearing is getting going. And if you remember in season one, at Tom and Shiv's wedding, Shiv confesses to Tom that she slept with Nate. And he's thrown, he's upset, he's heartbroken, all this sort of stuff. And she's like, it's no big deal, it's fine, we're fine. And he's like, can I at least throw that guy out of our wedding? And she's like, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. And so he like kicks Nate. He's like, we don't have a hotel room for you, you have to leave, and kicks Nate in a rare Tom power play sort of out of the wedding, because it's something Shiv has told him he's allowed to do. So I was wondering how much of this attack on Tom's unrelenting attack on Tom was payback from Nate through Gil for that thing in season one, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that, like, I like the way that Nate and Gil are handled in this episode, because Kendall isn't exactly wrong when he says that this is a personal vendetta thing on Gil's behalf. Mm-hmm. And Nate has a personal stake in it. And I think it just shows, like, how these public facing, you know, power holding people who are holding, you know, these companies' feet to the fire, they're compromised by it too in some way, usually, you know, like Gil is going, you know, on ATN 10 times or whatever, and Nate slept with the guy's daughter, you know, like they're, when everyone's that close in this kind of chamber of power, like, there's going to be overlap in all directions, and there's little purity of position, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very complicated. I really like that we have these figures and this political sphere, this hearing, this, you know, if we get a political season, which I'm really hoping we do, a Connor season, it's nice to build this groundwork for, like, what this fictional version of Washington, how it operates. I thought it was super interesting that Shiv goes down to talk to them. She has this little bag in her hand, which almost looked like a little, like, gift, but she doesn't have it when she gets into the office. So I almost wondered if it was, like, for Gil's assistant to, like, let mm-hmm. her into the office. I don't know. That's headcanon that I've made up, but I noticed that she has this little, like, this little gift bag with her. And I almost wonder if she was like, Sheila, hi, how are your kids? Here's this. Can I just sneak in? You know, he won't mind, sort
right,
of thing.
Right.
I feel like that'd be a very Shiv thing to do. But yeah, and this idea of Gil as, like, morally compromised by the fact that he has this righteous indignation about ATM and yet has appeared on the network 14 times in the last however many months or something like that. You know what I mean? So it's a fun portrait of our politicians. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the bottom of the heap. Greg and Tom are usually on the same level. We usually put them on the same level, but I'm going to put Greg slightly above because he's actually family and Tom isn't. And I think that matters for what's going to happen next. And so Greg is flipping out because he gets named in the hearing. And Logan's reaction to that is interesting. He sends him out of the room, but it doesn't seem like angrily. It's just sort of like, go calm down, but you're fine because mm-hmm. you're blood and you made the right choice. You chose me over your grandfather. So
right.
You're fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's an important distinction. Absolutely. I think also that in the course of the hearing gone wrong with Tom, Greg is made to seem like such a sort of low totem patsy that, like, he is way too small bore as was Bill, I guess, for this blood sacrifice thing, you know, as tall as he is, it still has to go over his head. You know, it has to be someone higher up. And so I think that weirdly gives him a position of safety. Did he make a really dumb decision? I mean, take the $250 million and just rid yourself of all of these monsters, but, like, that's not what he wants. So, yeah, that's why I think he's not bottom.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, I just want to make sure that we don't forget, this email. Let me see if I can find it. What is it? You can't make a Tom without breaking a few Gregs. Is that the,
A tomlet without breaking a few Greggs.
Can't make a tomlet without breaking some Greggs. So so good stuff. All right. So that brings us down to Tom. The tomlet himself. And so my big question to you, and this idea of like family and not family, this idea came back up in this week's episode when they're watching this news magazine show, with the whistleblower, and they talk about, an incident, no real person involved, right? That this was code that they used, in the Mo days to be like, this isn't a real person. And it's what's interesting is that that's similar to a phrase Shiv used earlier in the season, right? When Tom was like maybe contemplating hooking up with this woman Shiv knew, Shiv was like, no, that's a real person. You can't do this. I actually know her.
Yeah.
And so
this is vocabulary these people have.
And like, as much as we like to think of Shiv as like an enlightened or more progressive member of this family, like that's a mentality she has. And it's the same mentality, as the people that turn a blind eye to this abuse scandal. And so my question is Tom a real person to them? Is Tom someone with a face to them or is he not? Mm-hmm. And my bigger question to you is Matthew McFadden is such a great part of the show. I think the writers love writing for him. I think he the audience loves him, loves Tom.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
How bold and brassy would it be for the show to quote unquote kill Tom off? They keep using the terminology kill. They're not actually going to kill him probably, but, what if Succession got rid of Tom, even though he's a fan favorite? Would that be like the equivalent of like cutting Ned Stark's head off in Game of Thrones? Like, what do you think of that as a potential move?
I don't know. I kind of think they have too much fun with him, you know. But again, when we're talking about Shiv, like I wonder if we're almost at the end of it being plausible that they would keep someone like him around.
Yeah.
You know, he's really only there because he's married to one of them, you know, and because he's a complete nincompoop and just demonstrates that in public fashion, with some frequency this season. So yeah, I mean, I could see it going one of two ways. They just are kind of ruthless about it and, you know, he's thrown to the wolves, or like you were talking about next week, Shiv protects him in a way, and that is the kind of final thing in her season two downfall somehow. You know, she's, you know, kicked basically ostracized out of the family or something. I don't know. Or she takes the fall for Tom or something. Yeah. I don't know. But, his fate does feel very much in the balance.
Yeah, I can't decide what her downfall would be. Would it be getting rid of him or would it be protecting him? There's the downfall in her father's eyes, and then there's like sort of her complete moral decay. Mm-hmm. And if we want to look at sort of like what happened to Kendall in season one, Kendall was broken by this thing that happened to him and brought to heal, like, for his father. So if Shiv betrays Tom and that breaks her in a way, but she's firmly under her dad's thumb as a result of it, you know, I don't know. I don't know if it'd be interesting to repeat Kendall's storyline or to do something different. I don't know. And what's great about the show is I could not tell you which way it's going to go.
Yeah. No idea.
So
yeah. And I think both would make textual sense, which is nice. You know, like the way they've built the character, like she could go either way, and both options are completely, you know, agree with everything we've seen thus far.
Neither would feel out of, like, completely out of character as far as I'm concerned. Okay, here's my last question for you. Not knowing what's gonna happen to Tom in the finale, let's play what if. Shiv throws him under the bus, is there a storyline for Tom on the show that is outside Waystar Roy Co? I did it. Or outside his marriage to Shiv? Or does he just, like, you know, tuck tail and go back to Minnesota or whatever?
I think there could be. I think that if they cast him out, someone else with a competing interest might want to pick him up and use him as intel, essentially. They know he's dumb, but they know he knows a lot of things, which is a good combination for a competitor to Waystar Roy. So yeah, I could see that being a thing.
I wonder if we're building a conglomerate of, like, a Waystar Roy Co enemies, like people being cast out, right? Like Rhea and Tom. I'm sure we can figure out, you know, maybe they go work for Stewie and Sandy or something like that. You know what I mean? Like the enemy forces join forces or something like that. So I'd be interested to see it.
I have to say, with the Tom testimony led to, I think I, like, laughed out loud, my favorite line of the episode. It's a really dumb one, but like, I forgot who said it, but they're like, I'd give him a B+, B for bad plus terrible.
I want to say that was Hugo Fisher Stevens, just like kind of killing it.
So good.
Or maybe that was Frank. Anyway, and also
it was Frank. That's
okay.
What it was.
Another favorite moment for me is when they were like, do you know Greg? And he's like, no. And then you get the reaction room and they're like, no. Oh boy. Oh buddy. He did a real bad job. All right. So I mean, tune in next week to find out what happens to the Tomlet. And whether we have to struggle on without him. I genuinely don't know. We haven't seen the finale. I don't have a screener for it. So this is a fun space for me because it's pure speculation. All right. So until the finale, which we should say will go up a little late because we'll be watching on Sunday and recording on Monday. So it'll be in your feeds a little late. But until then, Richard, where can people find you?
I have a lot of work to do. I'm the webmaster for the Conheads website. So I just have to, like, well, if I'm not working on that, I'll be tweeting at Rylaz and writing for VF.com. Where will you be until next week? Our finale, Joanna.
Well, God bless you for your work with the Conheads. I will be tracking down the Atlantic writer who wrote the line, a smirking block of domestic feta.
That was David Sims. It has to be.
Oh, Simsy. Great. So my job's done. So I'll just be hanging out until next week. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find both of us talking about award season stuff on Little Gold Men. And we will see you next week.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.